I feared for these children, who were being punished before they had committed any crime, for whom the idea of existence would become synonymous with vengeance. I could do nothing but watch this tragic procession, even my life would be no help to them. I was not a redeeming Christ, and in any case I had discovered very good reasons for dying. We reached Danzig 3 days after crossing the ice of the Frisishaf. Everything was calm in the city, despite the tragic spectacle of hundreds of thousands of refugees. The war was to the south of us, so that we even escaped its noise, although frequent air raids struck at the heart of the crowded city. Danzig had become the terminal point of the Prussian exodus, and, although huge crowds were living day and night without shelter, there was nonetheless a substantial and organized effort to help them. It was still possible to leave for the west by rail, and the port was still open to maritime traffic. We waited down by the docks, in a dense mass of vagabonds. Wallace went to a center which should have been able to give us some information about reintegrating with our group. He waited for several hours under its flattened glass roof. I myself was in no hurry to move on, as the stiff folds of my boot pressed painfully against my swollen ankle. A large ship had come into New Fehwasser, and the crowd had flowed toward the pier. The ship had not yet cast off its mooring lines, and everyone would have to wait for several hours before they were loosed again, but in Danzig then time counted for nothing. Each aim was stubbornly pursued, even at the cost of maximum patience, endurance, and suffering. As always, there were children, with their small faces twisted by emotion, staring and hating without comprehension, and without looking for any explanations. When sleep overwhelmed them, they slept where they were, without any release from trouble. I, immobilized by exhaustion and by my sense of solitude, tried to see no more than the seagulls did, as they flew overhead, seemingly part of another world. For 2 days now, we had been waiting for some information, or some instructions, under the shattered glass structure of the station. A wind which made the inside as cold as the outdoors shook the metal frame, loosening and scattering the remaining glass fragments. We had to keep walking and waving our arms to avoid freezing on the spot. As it was very hard for me to walk, my comrades gave me a permanent place inside, while they took turns walking through the rubble of the port. Finally, a piece of negative information reached us. There were no Gross Deutschland units in Danzig. Perhaps they had moved on to Gotenhafen. Gotenhafen was several miles to the north, on the bay only a short walk, if my foot would support me. With the aid of Hals and my broomstick crutch, I managed to cross part of the town. On the way, Providence intervened to help us. Some civilians who had been watching us from their house came out to meet us, and took us back indoors. The house was warm, and it seemed as if the gates of paradise had opened to receive us. There was already a crowd of people in the house, refugees from the east, including large numbers of silent children, who seemed to relish the wall bench on which they were sitting as if it were a marvelous toy. There was water in the house, and our hosts offered us the opportunity to wash. Wallace knew that soldiers had no right to the privileges reserved for fleeing civilians. But his dressing was a mass of putrefaction, and his body was so exhausted he didn't know how to refuse. Even I was able to soak my swollen ankle in a basin of hot water. The owners of the house insisted that we rest there overnight and, in the evening, produced something for us to eat. We spent the night in the warmth of the cellar. Unfortunately, we were so unused to being warm that we couldn't appreciate it as much as we should have. We shook uncontrollably for seconds at a time, as if some form of warning system were on continuous alert inside our heads. Our exhaustion, which we had been keeping more or less suppressed, broke out during this period of unaccustomed rest. Lindbergh trembled for minutes at a time. Hals felt so lost if he fell asleep lying down that he spent the night propped against the wall, whimpering. As for me, I was racked down the length of my body with pains which seemed to rise and fall as I breathed. Were we no longer able to function like normal human beings? This was certainly possible. However, one development struck me as extremely favorable. The three hot soakings I was able to give my foot put an end to the trouble in record time. Perhaps, when our bodies have been deprived of practically everything, they react favorably to the most elementary care. Then, the most desperately wounded clung to life after a glass of schnapps and a promise. Today, a simple cold can flatten a healthy man for several days. Then, we were certainly not supermen, but men, in the most real and complete sense in the world. In the morning, we took leave of our benefactors, who told us that their last reserves had been exhausted, and that they were planning to leave Danzig and flee to the west while there was still time. With daybreak, which came late, the first fighter bombers appeared and attacked the port, and we said goodbye against the roar of explosions and the barking of flak. We resumed our march toward Gotenhafen, sharing the road with an unbroken column of civilians, who were all moving west, as Danzig could no longer be considered safe. Others were moving north, following the coast to Hala, a port opposite Gotenhafen, which was used almost as heavily as Danzig. Gotenhafen, about a month before its destruction, was a collection point for wounded men, who were then sent on to villages and hamlets inland. Others passed through it, to continue on the next lap of their miserable route, as always off foot. Hala was the next stop, some 30 miles beyond Gotenhafen. We questioned the groups of soldiers we met along the way. No one knew anything or had seen any trace of our unit. Someone suggested the assembly center. But when we got there, we hesitated to ask any questions of the harried officials, who had been overtaken by the course of events. A rumor was circulating through the throng of refugees. A large ship had been sunk a few days earlier, almost certainly after a torpedo attack. It had been crammed with refugees, relieved to be escaping to a region of greater security. It was easy to imagine the horror of the scene, in the black and icy night. The news of this disaster had been officially withheld, but had nonetheless penetrated to the anxious mob, for whom the sea route was the last hope of escape. The ship in question was thought to be the Wilhelm Gustloff. We had still been unable to obtain any information about our unit. Finally, we were reincorporated in a defense battalion which, with civilian aid, was constructing a line of defense to the west of Zoppot. We dug in, some 20 miles inland. I had no idea where the enemy was, but it seemed to me that the positions we were organizing faced the wrong way. The anti-tank and anti-aircraft guns pointed west and southwest, only directions in which a retreat was possible. I couldn't understand it, but that made no difference. It wasn't the first time, and others were undoubtedly thinking for us. Aside from the problem of civilian refugees, overflowing from every farmhouse and outbuilding, life was much easier here. The Prussian farmers continued to function with order and discipline, despite the anxiety which visibly marked their faces. The future looked dark, and the miracle which yesterday might have saved them now seemed much less possible. Despite orders to avoid despair and panic, and despite an effort to continue life as usual in the rush of the exodus, these people were quietly and surreptitiously beginning to liquidate their stocks, rather than lose them to the enemy. Many cattle were slaughtered for food, which later proved to have been wisely done. A short time after that, cattle were collapsing and dying by the hundreds on the frozen soil. Despite the hard work, and the endless watches and patrols, we regained some of our strength on a diet which was no longer tightly rationed. Meat had the greatest effect on our physical wretchedness, and we absorbed it, as the war absorbed everything, with maximum determination. Granz had returned to his old job. With the help of civilian volunteers, he set up a huge kitchen in an open shed. Two trucks shuttled between Zoppot, Gotenhafen, and Danzig. Ammunition for the front was organized here, and transported in small loads. With the exception of a few air raids, life went on in a state of striking calm, which seemed incompatible with the gravity of the hour, toward the end of the war, in the beginning of 1945. Even the cold had lessened, and we no longer dared look at the sky, which brought us such indecent clemency. We spent long hours engaged in activities created by the necessities of the times, but which nonetheless seemed to us like a diversion. Then one day toward the end of February, an organization which we thought no longer existed invited us back to Gotenhaven. Our Gross Deutschland group had collected a few fragments which were to be embarked for the West. Everything seemed to be improving. We separated ourselves from the battalion which had utilized our service, and said goodbye to the comrades we had made. Granz cleft the kitchen he had organized so efficiently, with regret. This break, however, saved us from the horrible ordeal in which that battalion was practically destroyed. Heaven, which had so often overwhelmed us, spared us this time. Russian tanks moved in from the west, and a storm of fire of unequaled violence broke over the positions we had so judiciously arranged. Our men took the first blow, but were soon swept aside. The Russians suffered frightful losses, but as we had learned, this made little difference to them. From Gotenhaven, where we were waiting for orders, the roar of the war rang louder than ever. Russian infiltration had penetrated to within 6 miles of the city, and our retreating troops were engaged in fierce fighting. Through the rain of shells which cut them down, the fleeing civilians entrenched in the countryside moved back toward town. Large German battleships were firing from the sea at advanced Soviet positions. The ground trembled and shook, and any window panes still in place fell out. We were trying to impose some sort of order on the swarm of terrified civilians who wished to embark for Halle. Retreating troops were also arriving in the city, which indicated that we could no longer count on our barrage. The town was gripped once again by frantic panic, and the civilians making their way to the port completed the paralysis of the order which had been maintained until then only with the greatest of difficulty. Although we all had evacuation papers, we were rounded up once again and sent to Zopot to fill a gap in the line. We left Gotenhaven, where despair had assumed a pitch of delirious intensity. With dry mouths and rage in our hearts, we climbed into the civilian cars which were to take us to our new Golgotha. Through the windows, which we kept shut against the cold, we watched the sky, where flights of fighter bombers buzzed like enraged wasps. At Brussels, we left our cars to plunge directly into the rubble. The town rang to the sounds of an exploding universe. The Russians were attacking everything that moved with rockets and bombs, and their planes came over so low we could almost see the grins on the pilots' faces. When they had gone, we moved back to our rickety cars, and started off again, through the flying dust. The road was strewn with rubble, and several times we had to dig our way through. We also had to skirt the enormous shell holes into which we otherwise would have disappeared entirely. Our journey ended when we were dumped, with our panzer forced, at the edge of a small village. We could hear the big guns some 10 minutes to the south. We ran toward a leafless hedge with a sidecar pulled up beside it. We thought we might receive some instructions, but we arrived too late. Both occupants of the sidecar had been shot. The driver had collapsed, over the handlebars, with his back reduced to a bloody pulp. The other man appeared to be asleep, but he too was dead. The bursts sounded closer each time. We had never imagined that the Russians were so close. Where were the rest of our men? Then we caught sight of them. We climbed over a garden hedge, and came out onto a smooth piece of ground which sloped up to the horizon, some 200 yards beyond and above us. Continuous trails of smoke marked the discharge of big guns and the impacts of their shells, and the grey sky was lit by flashes of white light. We had to reach that high ground whatever the cost, and we all had our passports for the West in our pockets. I knew very well what kind of curse lay behind the closed faces of each of my companions. As if the malevolence of the situation were drawing us on, we completed our progress with a series of carp-like leaps which were unknown to any system of physical training. 3 German half-tracks, which had been resuscitated from some unit, were pointing their DCAS at some 20 motionless Soviet tanks, waiting on the brown and white ground. Soldiers crusted with mud crouched in shallow, hastily dug holes, pointing various anti-tank weapons at the monsters, which kept their distance. We had barely taken our places when a new salvo came over, first the bursts, and then a thick fog of smoke, rolling toward us, level with the ground. We could hear cries and moans from our positions. The half tracks, which were more sheltered, were also firing, and all further speech was blotted out. The Russian tanks, which still did not move, began to fire too. Some of them seemed to be paralyzed, and the smoke leaking from their entrails mixed with smoke produced by our side, which a generous wind was blowing toward the enemy. Then an inhuman order sent us forward. As the tanks were not rolling toward our panzer forces, we had to go out to meet them. In a series of miraculous leaps we moved forward for several yards, through bursts of machine gun fire which felled several of my companions. Our fear reached grandiose proportions, and urine poured down our legs. Our fear was so great that we lost all thought of controlling ourselves. We drew still closer, tearing convulsively at our faces after each leap. The tanks were unaccompanied, and their myopia made their aim uncertain. One of them was burning, some 60 yards from a hole into which six of us had crowded. Then some of my comrades moved out. I stared after them with enormous eyes as they mocked their imminent deaths. Three tanks were moving toward us. If they rolled over the mound which protected us, the war would end for us in less than a minute. I can still see those tanks, blotting out everything else. I can also see the metal plaque, and the nose of my first panzer forced, and my hand, stiff with fear, on the firing button. As they rolled toward us, the earth against which my body was pressed transmitted their vibrations, while my nerves, tightened to the breaking point, seemed to shrill with an ear-splitting whistle. Once again I understood that one could wear out one's life in a few seconds. I could see the reflected yellow lights on the front of the tank, and then everything disappeared in the flash of light which I had released, and which burned my face. My brain seemed paralyzed, and made of the same substance as my helmet. To the side, other flashes of light battered at my eyes, which jerked open convulsively wide, although there was nothing to see. Everything was simultaneously luminous and blurred. Then a second tank in the middle distance was outlined by a glow of flame. It had not been able to take the three projectiles we had lobbed toward it with a considerable degree of precision. Our fingers clutched feverishly at the launching tube, which jutted against the sky somewhat to the left of the burning tank. We could hear the noise of a third tank crossing a hillock just beyond our position. It had accelerated, and was no more than 30 yards from us, when I grabbed my last Panzerfaust. One of my comrades had already fired, and I was temporarily blinded. I stiffened my powers of vision and regained my sight to see a multitude of rollers caked with mud churning past in a dull roar of sound some 5 or 6 yards from us. An inhuman cry of terror rose from our helpless throats. The tank withdrew into the noise of battle, and finally disappeared in a volcanic eruption which lifted it from the ground in a thick cloud of smoke. Our wildly staring eyes tried to fix on something solid, but could find nothing except smoke and flame. As there were no more tanks, our madness thrust us from our refuge, toward the fire whose brilliance tortured our eyes. The noise of the tanks was growing fainter. The Russians were backing away from the stubbornness which the devil seemed to have instilled in us. We collapsed onto the icy ground, whose touch seemed gentle to our exhausted bodies. The first three attacking tanks had been destroyed. The others, from each of which we pulled a wounded man, had been stopped. The rest had no longer wished to expose themselves to our desperate resistance. They would undoubtedly reappear in greater numbers, with the support of planes or artillery, and our despairing frenzy would count for nothing. We were still fighting, and, although the disproportion of our strength relative to the enemy's left us with no hope, our struggle was not in vain, because it allowed a host of civilians to escape. During a sleepless night, other German troops joined us. We re-established our positions, and laid down a minefield, which a fresh delivery of supplies from Danzig made possible. The mines were a powerful support for our defense, but unfortunately they were effective only once, and the Russians would certainly give the ground a preliminary going over with a heavy bombardment. For 3 days, the Russians had been launching intensive attacks toward the bay, attempting to cut off Danzig from Gotenhafen. Fahm had been seriously wounded, and once again we had been forced to give up some ground. This time, we had the invaluable support of naval artillery. If the Russians had not been though with such vast quantities of men and materiel, they would probably have been obliged to withdraw. The remainder of our forces was concentrated on a small piece of territory. The Russians were using planes against us, and it was above all their air power which overwhelmed us in the end. As we stared toward the horizon, we could see that the slightest projection had been eliminated. The territory, in which, even 6 months ago, life must have had a certain regularity and sweetness, was now experiencing an apocalypse. It was no longer possible to move during the day. The sky was constantly filled with Russian planes, which, despite the heavy opposition of our anti-aircraft defenses, always returned in constantly increasing numbers. Our defenses, moreover, were continuously weakening, as the evacuation of troops began. We were among the first to return to Gotenhafen, where certain sections of the city were already the scene of fierce combat. Within a few days, the appearance of the town had entirely changed. There were ruins everywhere, and a strong smell of gas and burning filled the air. The wide street which led down to the docks no longer had any definition. The wreckage of the buildings which had once lined it was crumbled right across the roadbed, obstructing all passage. Along with thousands of others, we were put to work clearing away the rubble, so that trucks filled with civilians could get down to the harbor. Every 5 or 10 minutes, planes came over, and we had to freeze where we were. The street was strafed and burned 20 or 30 times a day. Only our memories of Belgorod and Memel kept us from killing ourselves. We were no longer counting our dead and wounded, almost no one was entirely unhurt. Heavily laden horses, which must have been spared by supply, pulled a continuous train of sledges loaded with bodies wrapped in sacking or even paper. They had to be collected and buried with a speed which rivaled that of the Ilyushin's machine guns. Exhausted people stood stunned and motionless on heaps of ruins, creating magnificent targets for Russian planes. As a finishing touch, the horizon to the west and southwest was reddish black. House-to-house fighting had already begun in the outlying sections of the town, while thousands of civilians still waited down by the docks. From time to time, Russian shells reached as far as the embarkation area, and exploded there. We were trying to snatch a short rest in a cellar, where a doctor was delivering a child. The cellar was vaulted and lit by a few hastily rigged lanterns. If the birth of a child is usually a joyful event, this particular birth only seemed to add to the general tragedy. The mother's screams no longer had any meaning in a world made of screams, and the wailing child seemed to regret the beginning of its life. Once again, there was streaming blood, like the blood in the streets, and on the earth, where we had known so much suffering, and where my appreciation of existence was continually spiraling down toward the abyss whose depths I occasionally glimpsed, defining life as a mixture of blood and suffering and groans of pain. A short while later, after a last look at the newborn child, whose tiny cries sounded like a tinkle of delicate glass through the roar of war, we returned to the flaming street. For the child's sake, we hoped he would die before he turned 20. 20 is the age of ingratitude. It is too hard to be leaving life at the moment when one so much longs for it to flower. We helped some old people, whom younger ones had left to the mercy of the Soviets. In the darkness lit up by flames, we once again performed our duty. We supported and carried the old people down to the port, where a boat was waiting for them. Planes passed over, and in spite of the blazing fires which lined the street, they once again scattered their load of death. They killed some 15 of our number. We had tried to pull the victims down with us on our several rapid plunges to the ground, but the old people were unable to follow us. It didn't matter though, we saved a good many of them anyhow, finally hoisting them onto a trawler, after getting them through the thickly packed crowd. The boat had to slip its lines while loading, to escape an aerial attack. As we moved away from the shore, Wallace ran back to the stern to see if the gangplank had really been drawn in. Then he came back to us, tramping through the refugees who crowded the deck. He looked at us as if he were about to speak. Then we all turned to stare at the flames. "Do you still have your embarkation cards?" he asked suddenly. We all pulled out our tattered, filthy cards. "I would have lost my head first," muttered Gransk. The water slid quietly by, less than a yard below us. The boat would probably sink if the weight of its human cargo shifted. No one moved so much as a finger. Once again, we had escaped from the Russians and their fury. The West, Hala, Denmark, Kiel, the English prisoner. Before daybreak, we arrived at Hala, without incident. We had passed several ghostly ships, navigating without lights, going back to Hala, or to Gotenhafen, and Danzig, where large numbers of civilians were still waiting for deliverance. Hala, which I had thought of as a large town, proved to be only a village, with a harbor of very secondary importance. Many ships were anchored offshore, and small boats were delivering a steady stream of passengers fleeing to the west. We had scarcely set foot to the ground when the police, who were still functioning, made us step to one side. We stared at them with desperate unease. Was our good luck, which had brought us this far, going to melt like summer snow and send us back to Danzig, or Gotenhafen? The police turned their backs on us to direct the white-faced civilians. In any event, all of our papers were in order. But wasn't that the ship which was to take us further? And mightn't a counter-order arrive any moment? The minutes went slowly by, without giving us any glimpses into our future. As it grew light, the cumulative exhaustion of many months seemed to crush our shoulders. We were now able to see the numerous grey outlines of ships, including many warships, riding at anchor on both sides of the peninsula. As we looked, the air raid alarm sounded. Our eyes turned to the sky, as rumors began to circulate through the crowd. "No panic," shouted the police. "Our anti-aircraft defenses will hold them off." By now, we knew what that meant. All the shelters were filled with wounded, and each of us had to find what protection he could. If the bombs fell near the harbor, there would be an impressive carnage. We moved toward an old hulk pulled up on the shore, whose tarred timbers might be able to ward off a few blows. We hadn't quite reached it when the massive crackle of an anti-aircraft barrage burst all around us, fired by our coastal defenses or by one of the warships we had glimpsed earlier. This was my first experience of such a barrage. The falling fragments alone were capable of no small damage. To the east, the sky was spattered with numberless black spots. The noise of firing was so loud that we couldn't hear the planes approaching. Finally, we saw three of them, flying quite low, parallel to the shore, pursued by the black granules of exploding flak. We heard an explosion to the south. Over the water, one of the planes must have been hit. The police had not been exaggerating, not one plane flew over Hala. We felt a wave of confidence and security. Finally, the Russians had been stopped. The police came and checked our cards. "Be back here for embarkation on the underscore of March," a non-com told us. "While you're waiting, you can make yourselves useful north of town." We took ourselves off without any questions. "What is the date today?" Hals asked. "Wait a minute," Wallace said. "There's a calendar in my diary." He looked through his pocket, but couldn't find it. "In any case, we're not ahead of ourselves." "But we ought to know, all the same," Hals persisted. "I would like to know exactly how much longer we have to wait." We finally learned that it was Sunday, the 28th or 29th of March, and that we would have to wait for 2 days. As I remember, the last 2 days of the Ostfront, which had consumed so much of our lives. We spent those 2 days in the throng of anxious refugees camping out on the narrow Hala Peninsula. There were two more attempted Russian air raids. The last victim I was to see was a dirty white horse. A Russian plane had been hit, and was disintegrating above us. We all watched as the forward part of the plane, whose racing engine gave off a long howl, plunged toward the ground. The noise terrified the animal, which slipped its collar and galloped, whinnying, toward the spot where the roaring mass of metal would land. It must have taken about 3 steps before it was hit. Its flesh was scattered for over 15 yards, in all directions.